I'm joined in the studio with numerous guests whom will be introduced in a moment. You are listening to Off the Hour, breaking all corporate and state-created sound barriers on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Our discussion today is about the death penalty, and I have with me a studio filled with people who know about the subject. And so what I'm going to do is going to ask everybody to introduce themselves. So I'll begin with you, Charles. Could you please introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Charles Perreau. I'm from Amnesty International Canada Francophone. I work there as activism coordinator, but I'm also death penalty coordinator.
And I'm Judy Caruso. I'm a criminal defense attorney and a human rights activist.
I'm Gabby Petticelli, and I'm a volunteer for a lifers group for the last 10 years, and I have a background in criminology.
My name is Michel Dunn. I spent 17 years in jail for murder, and now I'm working with Lifeline. We work with lifers, and we help them to change their life and to get back in the community as a good citizen.
My name is Juan Roberto Melendez. I spent 17 years, 8 months, 1 day in death row. I'm the number 99 person in the United States to be released and exonerated from death row because of the issues of innocence.
And I would also like to introduce someone who is not among us today, Mr. Peter Collins. Peter Collins has contributed to CQT many times in the past. He's a naturalist artist as well as a cartoonist. His artwork has been exhibited in Montreal, Halifax, Toronto, and Ottawa. During 2004 and 2005, he has written and been published extensively on prison issues in various publications, such as the Journal by Prisoners on Prisons, to name one. In 2008, he received the Canadian Award for Action, which is given out jointly by Human Rights Watch and the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. He is currently incarcerated in the Bath Federal Prison, and he is in the 28th year of a sentence of life 25, and he also has deportation orders upon his release. And I would like to begin today's discussion because Peter wanted to ask you, Juan, some questions. So I'm going to read this out. First of all, he says, "It's always a sad and happy event when someone is long last exonerated. Sad because they were in prison illegitimately, and because we know there are many more, and happy because at long last you're out. Before this happened to you, did you have faith in the justice system? And also, when a conviction was reported in the news, did you doubt the verdict's accuracy? And what about now?"
Before I started, I did have faith in the system. I thought that when somebody is arrested for murder, they want to get the one that committed the murder. I find out different. The next question.
What about now? Like when a conviction was reported in the news, did you doubt the verdict's accuracy? Do you want me to ask another question? Okay. Have you given any consideration how society can prevent this kind of event happening over and over again?
What I would say to prevent it happening all over again is no way to fix it. You have to abolish the death penalty. It's the only way.
And should authorities who wrongly pressure a conviction be held to account? And how would this safety measure be enforced?
Can you repeat that again?
Okay. Should authorities who wrongly pressure a conviction, such as the police or the prosecution, should they be held to account?
Oh, sure, they should be held on account. In my case, when I was released, they only gave me $100, a pair of pants, and a T-shirt. I never even got an apology. So there should be a whole account. One of the problems we have in the states, especially in the state of Florida, they have what they call immunity, and the immunity protect them. They should take the immunity off the hands and hold an account.
Yeah, I think it is particularly important to hold these officials accountable for what they're doing, not only for the essentially a crime they've perpetrated on the innocent individual, but also because of public safety. Because when we have innocent people, we've had 135 people who have walked off of death row in the United States since 1973. When we have innocent people in our prisons, where's the real killer? Where's the protection?
Mm-hmm. Anybody else would like to comment on that?
Yes, me, I think they should be held accountable because they have committed the crime. It's a sure thing. And they don't know. I think they don't realize what it is to spend 10, 15, 20 years in jail. And they're going to go out of it by saying, oh, we are sorry. No, they made a mistake. Sometimes they hide proof. They hide evidence in favor of the defense. They should be sent in jail, those guys. That's it.
I agree. I do think they need to be held to a higher standard because since they're government workers and they're state officials, the level of accountability should be higher because they have people's lives in their hands, just like police, courts, all that. And I do think, though, it becomes a problem. What do you actually do with them in terms of trying them? Because you're trying them in the same court that they're usually used to trying other people. So you'd have to create almost like a separate entity, just like they do in military, you know, where you're tried somewhere else where at least there's impartiality. Because oftentimes, even if something does happen and you do pursue accountability, nothing ends up happening in the end because they all know each other and they protect each other usually.
So you're kind of saying that in the prison system, it would be very difficult to enforce anything.
Definitely. Here. It would have to be something outside of that.
Judy, would that be the same, or Juan, would that be the same as in America as well?
Yes, it's the same in America as well, and there should be a whole account because of the suffering the family of the person that is wrongfully convicted. In my case, I spent 17 years, 8 months, 1 day in death row for a crime they did not commit. That's 17 years, 8 months, and 1 day that my mama was on her knees praying for a miracle.
And like in Juan's case, I mean, the prosecutor only got taken off homicide cases, but he never got any other reprimandation or anything. He's just like go as business as usual. And if I'm not mistaken, in Juan's case, to actually get the things fixed, they needed to go to a different county to. So, yeah, they actually need to go elsewhere to try and seek reprieve for these crimes.
Peter has also questioned whether a public inquiry for each wrongful conviction that is exposed be an appropriate place to start, like start for, I guess, to try to solve the issue in what way? Does anybody comment?
I do, actually. I think it is a good start because I do think that the only way to change things is to have public pressure to actually lay charges on these people. And I think the more it's out there, and it has to be out there in the media, and that's what I think people need to do, is they have to put it at the forefront of the debate so that everyone knows about it, even the woman who stays home, and, you know, that it's actually in the news, which is difficult oftentimes because the news often works for these kind of institutions. They work for police, they work for the courts. But we have to try to really put it at the forefront because I think if people actually knew what went on, there'd be much more of an uprise. And people, that's what it is. It's power in numbers, like anything else. If everybody stands up and pressures, something's going to get done. So I do think that that's a good place to start.
Mm-hmm. She's absolutely right. We got a case right now in the state, United States, a case of Troy Davis in Georgia. His death warrant has been signed 3 times, and because of the public outcry, he has got a state execution. So we got to rally, we got to do rallies, we got to do a lot of grassroots work, we got to build bases, we got to not to fall asleep, we got to attack the system.
And I think the public inquiries, of course, are very important because it helps us figure out what we're doing wrong. And once we know what we're doing wrong, we can hopefully make changes to the system so that we can prevent these kinds of atrocities from ever happening again. I mean, we've learned a lot from the from all of the folks walking off of death row because of innocence. We've learned a lot about the unreliability of eyewitness testimony. We've learned a lot about the unreliability of snitch testimony. But there's a whole lot more we can learn.
Also, there must be, it's great that these 135 are now off of death row, but what about those ones that, and I'm sure there have been more than we would like to admit, that have been executed and they have been innocent. Are there very many exonerations post-mortem, although that doesn't help the victim in here, but are there many of those?
There have not been very many, but fairly recently there have been some studies done, some investigations done that have shown us, we've just learned, it's been reconfirmed that an innocent man was executed in Texas in 2004. He was executed based on junk science. The case involved an arson, was supposedly an arson, and several renowned world experts in arson have now stated that the testimony of the quote arson was worthless in terms of any scientific basis, and that the fire was accidentally caused. Mm-hmm. So we know for sure that was Cameron Todd Willingham in Texas. We also know about Ruben Cantu in Texas, Carlos de Luna in Texas, Larry Griffin in Missouri. Juan has there's some folks who were on death row and executed in Florida who Juan is convinced of their innocence.
I know about five of them that I'm quite sure that, and they had done investigation on them way before these cases came out. Jesse Tefaro, Benny Dems, Pedro Medina, Leo Jones, and a dear friend of mine, Angel Nieves Diaz, they offered him 5 years, and he refused to take it because he did not commit the crime and end up getting executed.
And there's not that many that comes out because there's not a lot of resources put into finding out after the fact, because there's so many guys claiming innocence that are currently jailed that we don't know for sure that many. Like, we'll probably never know for sure about the guys Juan just mentioned. There's a few, and like at Amnesty, we got maybe 8 or 9 currently that we believe were wrongly executed, but of course there's much more. And like we've seen in the past couple of years with the Houston Crime Lab being found guilty of manipulating DNA evidence, not even that technology is safe from going around the way to find a guilty party and not the guy that committed the crime.
Yeah, we do believe, we're very optimistic in the United States that this issue will actually be the impetus for full abolition of the death penalty. Mm-hmm. Just as it was in Britain 4 decades ago. It's too bad it's taken so long for people in the United States to recognize the reality of the system.
And what kind of comments would you, either Judy or Juan, like to say to the Canadian public here? Because there's a lot of people who, they're very influenced by media, by cop shows and things like this, and it's like, oh yeah, we got to bring back the death penalty here in Canada. And of course it didn't work. I mean, it was just a couple years ago, I think somebody got exonerated after post-mortem from like the 1950s. They finally accepted, yes, this guy was innocent, you know, but at least his family could, you know, then live the rest of their years with that. And you know, I'd just like to know what you would like to say to the Canadian public on this.
Well, I would tell you, what I would like to let the Canadian public know that bringing back the death penalty is a step backwards. Also, I would like to say that the international voice is very important in the United States. One of the things that helped me a lot, I believe it helped me a lot, was when I was inside, I wrote a testimony, and I wanted people to put it in the internet in the States, and I was writing everybody I could. So I write the Canadians against the death penalty. Two friends of mine that I would like to meet them before I leave, Tracy and Davey, and they put my testimony in the internet, And I think that helped me a lot. So any involvement, Canadians, Europe, any international country that get involved, they don't have the death penalty, and send letters to the President of the United States, send letters to governors, send letters to legislators, it helps a lot.
I think that the folks in Canada should never consider reinstating the death penalty, because if they look at what's happened in the United States, it brings nothing but more pain and more suffering, many, many problems. The damage that the death penalty inflicts on so many people involved in the system is limitless, practically. The damage on the lawyers, even the damage on the families of the person who is on death row, the person who's executed, it's so needless, because it doesn't resolve anything. The death penalty does not reduce murders.
Mm-hmm. Also, the damage of the victim filing for murder. It takes a long time for a person to get executed, and every time this condemned man get a state execution, it opens the wound again. They see the picture of the loved ones in the TV, on the paper, and it's all open again.
It also costs economically so much more than to have an alternative in place. And that's money, especially in the economy that we're now living in. That's money that needs to be spent elsewhere to prevent crimes, to protect the community.
Mm-hmm. I would also like to talk about not just the fact of being innocent, obviously that is the most extreme, but just the moral implications, of just the even thought of the state executing somebody like in all their name. Like if the Canadian state brought back the death penalty and they were executing, killing, murdering, and I've read testimonies from former wardens even that have even actually led people to execution, you know, in the United States, and they're really messed up over mm-hmm. all of this, and one he even stated this is the most premeditated murder, and so basically what we're saying is that. So I just would like to, maybe Michelle, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, by me. The more I hear, the more I am happy to be a Canadian, you know? And sure, it's a premeditated murder, and not many persons have experienced it, I dealing with the death of somebody. And the only thing I can say is, for me, I would prefer to explode, to disappear, than to do it again or to be confronted to it again.
Also, you, not just yourself, but you know of many other people who have been in prison, done their time for murder, manslaughter, whatever, and they're now living successfully in society. Could you comment on that as well?
Yes, we are talking just in Quebec. 500 people are now living outside a productive life. They take care of their family, they work, they give their time to share their experience and what they have learned in jail, because they don't want people to do it, and they talk about it. So it's a success, and there is a sure thing. The number of murders in Canada is going lower and lower every year. So why would we change a system that works very well for a system that doesn't work at all? And we know it. And I would say that recidivism, when we're talking about murderer, is less than 0.5%. And when I am talking about recidivism, I'm not talking about violent crime. I'm talking about breach of condition. The guy is having a beer when he cannot have a beer, so he's going back to jail for that. So we have it's the greatest success, and we're talking about taking it off. I can't understand it. Mm-hmm. But me, I'm sure that if we talk and if we explain it to people, they will understand very well.
I understand everything my friend McGee is saying. The thing that people don't know in death row is when they execute these people, they're not executing the same person that committed the crime. When I went to death row, I did not know how to read, I did not know how to write, I did not know how to speak English, I did not know no law, I was an angry man. They taught me how to read, they taught me how to write, they taught me how to speak English. They taught me how to let out go anger, bitterness, hate. So they're not killing the monster they think they're killing. When it boils down to it, they're killing a human being.
Gabby, what have been your experiences doing volunteer work with men who have life sentences?
My experience has been, well, in terms of the death penalty, we're talking about morally, I just think it's archaic and prehistoric that the state would actually, you know, build on this concept of an eye for an eye. If we're talking about justice, what does that accomplish? I mean, is it just pure out revenge of, you know, killing someone? And like we were talking about before, it puts a high level of onus of responsibility on juries, on this affects a lot of people. And I just think to actually be discussing, having a discourse on the death penalty, to me, if I was from the past and I shut to the future, I wouldn't believe that this is still something that's being discussed, because to me, it's out of this world. In terms of my experience with the lifers, thank goodness there's no death penalty here, because they'd be on death row. And also, I don't know if the Canadian public understands what a lifer is in Canada. I think, I don't know if Michelle wants to go through that a bit, because people I run across have this misconception. They don't understand. They say, a lifer? Well, why is he out then if he's a lifer? They have this concept that you're... Would you mind, Michelle, just clearing it up for the audience, yeah, maybe, of what it means in Canada to have a life sentence?
Yeah, having a life sentence in Canada, it means that me, I've been out for the last 13 years, but I'm still on parole. And just for example, if I would be caught driving my car with alcohol, I would be in jail for 2-3 years before they hear about me. So I have to stay on the line, and I have to have an exemplary life. And I have accounts to towards the society. I have a parole officer meeting with me every 3 months. I'm not totally free, but I'm free, and that's the most important thing. But no, they don't do that without calculating the risk. Mm-hmm. And when the system is telling to a lifer, you can go out, it's because the guy, he can go out. That's it.
Mm-hmm. And I think with the parole meetings, they'd start a lot closer together, not every 3 months, but at what... Like, is it a weekly, monthly?
When you go out? Oh, yeah, it's 1 a week, mm-hmm, and you cannot have any encounter with a guy with a record. You cannot drink. You cannot have you cannot go in the bar. You can't go further than 30 kilometers without telling your parole officer. You have to be, if you are in a halfway hour, you have to be in before 11 o'clock. If you go in your family, you have to say that. If you go to see your girlfriend, you have to say that. No. It's a system that works to help the guy to go out progressively. And mm-hmm, they look at what he's doing to be sure that he's doing well. And yeah, with the time, they give him more freedom, because they see that he's able to manage it. Mm-hmm.
I've got another question for Juan here from Peter Collins. This one was, one thing seems clear to me. If the legal authority is proven to have acted in bad faith to obtain a conviction, there should be serious consequences, at least on par with the conviction that they sought to impose wrongly on an innocent person. This should be true for jailhouse informants and members of the public. What are your thoughts on this?
I think... jailhouse informants, prosecutors have to be real careful how to deal with them. The problem we have in the States is it's not about justice, it's about winning. And I'm not going to say they're all prosecutors like that, but the ones that I hear about, is they're not showing, they're not working on the best interests of the public. So there's a lot of things have to be changed.
Yeah, the main problem is that most of prosecutors and judges in the U.S. are elected officials. So basically, they have to be seen as tough on crime to protect public safety. So it's a win or lose. It's like in sports. You don't want to have a 500 I mean, record. You mean to want to have the best record possible, and sometimes they bend the rules or they bend the ways they go about getting a conviction, and that's what happened clearly in one's case. And that's why they need to be more safeguards to protect innocent people from getting convicted, and not just in death penalty cases, but in all kinds of cases. I mean, we've seen recently in Pennsylvania where thousands of youth were wrongly convicted or sentenced to harsher sentences just because the judges were taking, two judges got convicted of taking $2.5 million each of bribes from a private prison system. So that's very serious. I mean, we're talking about shattered lives for youth that get a criminal record after that, and that stays with them in most cases.
Charles, I was just saying, because you were talking about the U.S., do you think it's much different in Canada? Like, do you think that the system actually, in terms of prosecutors and all that, that it's different?
Well, in terms of probably some people, I mean, some prosecutors might not play by the rules as well, but since we don't elect the prosecutors and judges here, I mean, that at least puts a better safeguard on it. I mean, it doesn't prevent any rule bending, but at least it's a better safeguard for it. And like, since we're at least not yet don't have the private prison system that the U.S. have, although the Canadian government clearly wants to get that way, that the public must know what the private system is about. It's about making money like any other business. And to make money, you have to keep bringing guys in. So the interest is not in rehabilitating guys. It's about keeping them inside.
And my name is Dee, and I'm in the studio, for those who are just tuning in, with Charles Perreault from Amnesty International, Judy, who is a lawyer, and she's from New Mexico. We got Gabby Petticelli, who is a volunteer with Lifers for the last 10 years. Michelle Dunn, who is a lifer and also works with Lifeline, and of course, Juan Melendez, who did 17 years, 8 months, and 1 day on death row to be the 99th prisoner in the United States to be exonerated. And we're up to a number 135 that we know of so far, I guess. And also I'm asking questions on behalf of Peter Collins, who is a prisoner, and he has a life sentence, and he is presently incarcerated in Bath. And that's just outside of Kingston in Ontario. So Peter would like to ask Juan some more questions for you. There's a few of them here. He goes, I'd also like to know how you have managed since you were released from the cages. Do you experience many debilitating social issues? Have you found it hard to fit in? Is it hard to trust people? Do you feel a part of society? Just on that, you know, just to go on that.
That's a good question. When I first got out, I was very lucky that I had a lot of support from my family. I had a lot of, and when I went back to the island, I'm from Puerto Rico. When I went back to the island of Puerto Rico, they treated me like a hero. So they offered me jobs, and it was very nice. But I do have problems. Everybody that has been incinerated, out of the 135 that have been incinerated, we all suffer from post-traumatic distress. I get nightmares. I am lucky if I sleep 4 hours a night. I get up all kinds of times and nights. I never can get this cannot get them out of my mind, the people that I left behind. So I'm very lucky that I got a lot of support. Some of us do not have the same support that I have. I know some of them already that they're back in prison again for something probably they did. Some of them are on drugs. In the 135, some of them are on drugs. Some of them are alcoholics. Some of them even commit suicide after they've been out. So it's a struggle for us. We don't get no support from the government, no therapy, nothing like that.
And so you left the prison with they just gave you $100 and that was it. You're leaving death row. And Michelle, your experience was so different. Maybe we could talk about the comparisons on that.
It's difficult to make a comparison because it's terrible. When we go out from Canada, from a jail in Canada, we are guilty and we have more money than that, and we have a lot more support. Me, going out of jail after having spent 10, 15, 20 years, it's like going into China without money, without work, without the language, and you have to find an apartment, you have to find a job. It's very difficult. And here in Canada, we have that kind of support. Let's say Lifeline, we have a house. We can welcome 12 guys, and they are there for the period they want. They have the time to adapt to their new life, and they have the time to do it without the stress. And it's very important, because it's the adaptation period is necessary. And we have to say to that, during the period they are inside, they have addressed their problem. If they had an alcohol problem, they have worked on it. If they had a violence problem, they have worked on it. Psychologists, programs. So the guys are going out well equipped, but they need support to adapt to their new life into society. And we have it in Canada. Me, I'm so... I can't believe I'm hearing what is going on in USA. It's incredible.
But I am aware of certain prisoners, it takes them a long time to get out, and even if they do have good records, such as Peter Collins, who received such a prestigious award, there were people, you know, that were saying, why is this man who's a lifer was able to, you know, to even be able to have such a war? And luckily, the Human Rights Watch and everything, they saw the work that he was doing in preventing contagious diseases in prison, and also writing up a lot of literature and everything to have that distributed to prisoners and everything. However, he's in his 28th year of life, 25, and you know, we could say for the last say 15 plus years, he's like got an absolutely clean record. So there, it seems like there's some kind of a political pull in certain ways. I do know though that Peter Collins has criticized certain things in the Correctional Service of Canada. Do you think that that could be a possibility?
Oh, sure. Me, I've seen a few guys with high-profile case, for example, when the public is is looking at what's happening in one case or the other. Yeah, we can have a different rule for a few guys. It's a sure thing.
Well, in my experience, let's say working with the Lifers Group for the last 10 years, we've run into numerous problems in terms of many guys being way past their parole eligibility date. And I know that in comparison to the U.S., it's a much better situation, but it's, and from my experience and what I've dealt with in terms of the different problems that have arisen within our guys that are in a minimum on their way out, and some of the guys on the outside, they've been racked with numerous problems in terms of the institution, in terms of being put back in for reasons that don't merit being put back in, and just a bunch of problems. And I do think that things need to be worked on a lot better also with lifers on the outside.
I would like to add maybe a thing. When I hear that a guy has been in jail for 28 years, I hear that that guy is socially dead. It's very hard to bring back a guy after 28 years because he has no more contact with anything in the real society. I've seen numerous guys telling me, I cannot do that. I have to go back in jail. It's too hard for me to... Cars are going too fast. The life is too fast. I have to go back in jail. It's terrible. 28 years is a death penalty for me.
It is known, though, that even though Canada doesn't have the death penalty, and thankful, we're all thankful for that, that we have, for Western countries, we have one of the longest sentences. Of course, it is surpassed by the United States, but in comparison to a lot of countries around Europe, it's not comparable, so...
I do think they did, when they abolished the death penalty, they had to make some concessions and they had to, like, trade at the table in order to get it done. And I think what happened was because prior to, there was a moratorium on the death penalty for numerous years where people weren't actually being executed, but it was being commuted. And the average sentence was they'd get a sentence, but they wouldn't be on parole for life. And then that was the bargaining chip that was used to abolish the death penalty. And we came with these longer sentences and life on parole, which didn't exist before for the same kind of crime. And getting back to what Michelle was talking about in terms of all the resources available, I do agree with you, Michelle, that there are resources available, but those aren't always the right resources that the guys need. From my experience, a lot of them say that community support is very important, because once you go out on the street, who hires you? We need prisoner-friendly places that are willing to give a guy a chance. I mean, I know some guys that were in our group that are out, that are working at a hotel and doing fantastic. He's the star employee, and they gave him a chance. People need out there need to give these people a chance. We're all part of society, and the ills that happen and the crimes, we all have to take a societal responsibility. It's not in a vacuum where a person, you know. So I do think we should all help in the reintegration process.
I wanted to ask something that I have problems right now to get a job, because when they give me an application, they say, "Where you work lately?" Ain't no working there, bro.
The last 20 years, there's nothing.
Exactly. So they need to do like I saw a place in Europe, but this is handicaps. This they got a man that owns a restaurant. He only hires handicaps. Handicaps. It was so beautiful. And the same thing like you were saying, they need to have people that, with companies that are willing to take a person that's been locked up for so long and give him a hand and train him, and maybe he can go back.
Exactly. I agree with you. And people need to change their conception. When a guy's coming out after a long term inside, like you said, that suffers from institutionalization, that hasn't been out and knows... People have to be more receptive, and they need to help, because these people are coming back into our society. We want them to be successful. So you got to give them a chance, give them a job, and try them out and help them in any kind of way in accepting them back into society. Because by rejecting, it's not going to help anything.
One of the biggest problems that I had when I got out was the technology. I didn't know what a cellular was. They hand me a cellular. What am I going to do with this? And my lawyer handed it to me, and he said, "Hey, that's like a phone. Put it in your ear. I disconnected with your mama." And the DVDs and all that. I never saw people getting money out of the bank without going inside the bank. See, all that stuff.
That stuff's very important, and that's what I'm saying. That's lacking. It's not the system that's going to do that for you. It's people. Let's say in my lifers group, that's what we do. We go on outings. We ride the metro system. They learn how to ride the metro. They learn how to go to a library and take out things. They learn how to use a bank machine. Like, these simple little things oftentimes are not taken care of by the criminal justice system. So although it is better, there's still, I think, community needs to get involved. And from the guys in my experience that I've been dealing with over the years, they all say, thank goodness for a group like you or like your guys or that people like, you know, Cooper, different people that are, you know, more receptive. They say, thank goodness for that. But a job is definitely a big issue, I think, for guys coming out.
Yeah. A job and resources. Those are the most important things that a guy needs. Mm-hmm. And I would like to add, when as a society we decide not to kill murderers, we also decide to give them the chance to go back into society. Mm-hmm. So we have to leave them a place when they go out. Mm-hmm. But I must admit that in Quebec, it's probably the easiest place for that, because people are very welcoming, but there are still problems. Let's just talk about insurance. No company insurance wants to insure inmates now. They don't want to insure inmates. They don't want to insure the family of the inmates if he's living there. So it's a big, big problem.
This is just in Quebec, though, I believe.
Yeah, just in Quebec, exactly.
Getting back to the work, I do know of a lifer who recently got out after 25 years, and he's got a job, and he was wondering, and he's got a fairly good job, and he's lucky to have had it, and he was doing a lot of junky jobs before, you know, cutting lawns or anything to make a buck, you know? And right now he's saying, though, he's working with these guys, and he's in a machine shop and everything, but, you know, little things like those everyday things that everybody else knows, they don't know. And sometimes they look at him like, where you been? You know, like, you know, and of course he doesn't want to say, and he's asking me, should I? And of course, I don't know these people. What would that mean? These are very difficult questions. And if we lived in a more open society that would say, hey, you're doing really well, you know, be a part of the community, I think that would make a big difference.
I agree with you totally, yes. Mm-hmm. And that's what I said a few minutes ago. The guy is coming from China. instead of going there. So he has to learn a lot of things, and it's very stressful. And luckily, we have more and more people that accept to welcome and to help those guys.
One of the problems I had when I got out is even crossing the streets. When I left, it was four lines. Now it's eight. The truth is, I almost got hit by a car three times. And then now I wait for the little man in the light, and I wait for all the people to cross, and then others follow them. I'm very, very paranoid.
So what do you think that we could ask from the community to do, whether that be in the United States or in Canada? What we could, because we're here on the air now, what could we ask for the community?
Well, I can start. What I would ask for the community is to become involved more in your community, because I think just in general, across the board, there's the breakdown of the community, and I think that's a purposeful thing, to divide and conquer and to keep people in their own little cubicles. And, you know, instead of love your neighbor, it's neighborhood watch and watch what your neighbor's stealing. You know, like, it's all this kind of crime prevention mentality, and I do think that's economical. They want that, because the crime prevention industry is one of the most booming industries around, and without that, there wouldn't be as much money. Like, also with the private prisons, but with everything, every apparatus that has to do with criminal justice makes loads of money. So I do think people need to be informed more, and I think people, there has to be a general change of attitude where, how do we see this? You know, what is the criminal justice there for? Is it to punish? Is it to, you know, reintegrate? If you're going to say reintegrate, you have to actually reintegrate, you know? And not just say it, and people are lost and have nowhere to go, because that's not going to help in the end.
And so, but how to get the community, like, into the prisons, though? This is another thing, too, like...
But that's attitude. Like we said, people have a negative... there's a lot of propaganda, you know, like what the news tells you in this, you know, about crime. I mean, crime's been decreasing for the last 10 years, but if you watch the news, you think it's, like, you know, around the corner, and if you walk out, you're going to get mugged, you know? Like, there's that kind of perception. And I think we have to fight that and try to get the community more involved on every level, because, like I said, there seems to be, like, a breakdown in the community, and we just have to stick together instead of dividing and implicating. And we have to realize that crime in general is a societal ill, okay? So it's for whatever reason, economics, you know, different things. We all have to take responsibility, and we all have to engage to make things better and to help people that are coming back. So I do think it would take a lot, and it needs a completely rethinking of what you perceive as crime and justice and what you want from this.
Okay, so a lot of groups that work with reintegration, jobs seems to be...
Jobs is a major thing. Give people a chance.
Mostly, I think, too, is the lack of knowledge of the problem. So we have to try to find ways to educate the people, to let them know about this problem. Have a life, probably can create a newspaper and give it free and tell all the good things that these lifers have been doing, and they're not as bad as the people think, and cut that propaganda off.
That is the problem, but with a Harper government in Canada, that's very difficult, because I think one of the initiatives is to divide and conquer and make everybody fear for their lives. But as a community, we have to stick together as a community. I think people need to get together and really fight this.
I know that the Harper government had recently put out their 109 recommendations, and that the prestigious lawyer from out in BC, Michael Jackson, who's written numerous books on prisoners and human rights, as well as the former director of the John Howard Society, Graham Stewart, they recently did a press conference, but it wasn't really on the local TV stations or CBC. Like, they just have maybe a little blip in the media.
You know why? They didn't show up, Dee, because it's not, you know, it's not the state, you know, so many of the media didn't bother showing up.
But one thing they did say about this report was just they were very concerned about the absolute lack of human rights. It did not acknowledge that at all. In fact, they were stating that for guys that are in segregation, to give them more segregation. And, you know, it was just like really pushing pushing the idea of the private prison industry, pushing everything in like a U.S. style prison system, which obviously has not worked, as we see that the United States incarcerates, I believe, more people per capita than any other country in the world. Is that right, Judy?
That's correct.
I believe that is correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's about over 2 million people in U.S. prisons out of a population of around 300 million. Mm-hmm. So that's a whole lot of people in there. And back to what you were saying about the Kenyan government, I mean, I was reading a few days ago, one of our, I forgot which minister it was, but he was justly mentioning that human rights were expendable in the face of security, that they were okay if it didn't go around public security, which is a joke. I mean, how can you go to be safe without human rights being respected? I mean, it opens the door to all kinds of violations in the name of public security, of so-called human public security.
So that's something we're going to have to look closely about for the future. I have one more question here from Peter Collins for Juan, and it is in regards to your time that you did spend on death row. He's wondering, like, how did you survive in there? And he goes, I'm glad you did survive, and I'm especially glad that you speak out against what happened to you and shine the light in the darkness. I know that your authority gives hope to others. So he'd like to know how you did survive.
It was like a roller coaster. It was times after 10 years, I almost committed suicide. Suicide thoughts was a lot of time in my mind. I survived. One of the ways I survived was accepting the situation. I know I cannot beat the system. It had to be a miracle to come out. And when I saw these fellow friends of mine condemned to death that was worrying about it so much, I saw their hair get white and I saw them first in 2 years the hair was all white. I saw the depression in the face. They getting all before time because they were so much. Some of them just went crazy. Some of them just committed suicide. I saw all that, and I know they did not accept the situation. I did came in to accept the situation and put in all their hands in God, and that's one way I survived. Also, I survived with the help of pen pals. Every time I'm a lot of letters from this great nation of Canada, they wrote me so many letters that made me feel that I was not alone in this situation. There was people out there didn't care if I was guilty or innocent. And I say, this is something that I got to hang on. I survived also because of my family, my mama and my aunts. They wrote me so many letters. And they make the letters that gave me so much will, so much hope and keep me the will to, give me the will to live. And the part of being innocent helped me survive too. I lost hope sometimes, but the hope to me was just like a little kid when he's learning how to walk. He falls down, but he gets up again and he tries to walk again. So that's how I grabbed the hope. Every time I got an appeal that was denied, it was a terrible blow for me. I said, they're going to get me. They're going to kill me. And why satisfy them? I'm going to satisfy myself. And that's when suicide thoughts was coming to my mind every time I lose appeal. But some kind of way, I get this good dreams, and I take this wonderful dreams like a sign of hope that one day all will come back. And 17 years, 8 months, and one day, The miracle came through. But I wonder, sometimes I tell God, why you had to take so long?
I think one of the things that Juan mentioned were the letters from pen pals. And if folks up here in Canada are interested in helping those who are on death row, one of the most important things for them is to receive letters from outside, to receive letters that make them feel, as Juan has said, like a human being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pen pals, that's a one way of the community getting in contact with the... Yeah.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like, I am in touch on a personal basis with several, and like I can personally testify, basically sometimes it's the it makes the, all the difference if the guy is going to commit suicide, if he's going to make it through. They need the support. So of course, there's going to be big ups and big downs while doing time. But the difference, like Juan was mentioning, is getting letters. I mean, a simple letter doesn't need to be a book. It can be a short letter, but just that the fact that someone thinks about you can make the, all the difference in the world for some inmates and give them the hope and the courage to get through their ordeal and get back into society.
And on a systemic level, I just wanted to thank everybody in Canada and also in Europe who helped us abolish the death penalty in New Mexico on March the 18th of this year. The outside pressure was extremely important to our governor, Governor Bill Richardson, who very much valued the input of the international community. It was extremely important for him to hear from you all.
Yeah. And we're coming towards the end of our show, and I'd just like to go around if everybody could maybe say a quick something. And I know that, Charles, there is something happening up at the Université de Montréal tonight, so maybe you'd like to give that information out to our listeners.
Yeah, of course. Tonight at in an hour time at 7 o'clock, we'll be having a big conference with Michelle and Juan, making a much thorough testimony, giving a more thorough testimony. So that's at 3200 Jean Briand at University of Montreal. The room is B2285.
And thank you very much, Charles. And Judy, do you have any last words?
I would just encourage people to become very involved in matters within their communities. Unfortunately, in the United States, we're so lacking in that department. And it's really rather refreshing to hear what's going on up here in relative terms. People really care about other people up here, whereas unfortunately in the United States, it's really all about oneself.
Mm. And Gabby?
I guess in the same vein, I would just say that people just need to get involved more. And that's why I look to Native American culture, because as Art Solomon, a famous elder, once said, is when someone does something wrong in our community, we don't ask what's wrong with you. We say, what have we done wrong? And I think people need to re-envision societal responsibility, and that people that do fall and commit different crimes and do that, we're all responsible for the betterment, because we have to take it in the societal context.
And Michelle?
In Canada, we have 1,500 people who are the living proof that a guy can rise from the most horrible crime and become a good citizen and a very good human being. We have only to look at those guys.
And Juan?
I just want to thank every Canada for receiving me. It's my fourth time being in Canada, twice in Toronto, and twice right here in Montreal. It's always been a pleasure to be here. Also, I want to say, tell the lifers that don't lose hope. You got good people behind you. Keep your hopes high and keep thinking positive. Never think negative.
Well, I want to thank you all, and I also like to thank Peter Collins, who unfortunately could not phone in today, but he did give me a call with those questions, and I'll let him know about your answers, okay, Juan?
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
That does it for